won't say it's simple, but it's been done often enough where we don't have to come up with some new technology. I mean, a lot of folks before us have figured this out.
Offshore Arctic drilling edges forward. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, why are dead seabirds washing up on Bering Sea shorelines?
There's a shift in the system that takes away the prey that you're used to and replaces it with prey that you're not used to. You may literally be going to the wrong grocery store.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Over the last few years, efforts to drill for oil in the Arctic Ocean put Alaska at the center of an international debate. It's a highly political topic, one both former President Barack Obama and President Donald Trump weighed in on, and to this day, there hasn't been any oil produced from Arctic waters solely owned by the federal government. But over the last year, several steps were taken to change that. Two companies' efforts to drill for oil in the Beaufort Sea are moving forward. And at least for now, they've largely avoided the national spotlight. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has more details.
When it comes to drilling for oil in Alaska's Arctic Ocean, you might think not a lot is happening. First, there was this development in late 2015, as heard on NPR.
Royal Dutch Shell is stopping its drilling operations in the Arctic for the foreseeable future.
Then on Fox Business last December, there was this headline.
President Obama is taking new action to indefinitely bar offshore drilling in areas of the Arctic and Atlantic Oceans.
Yes, Shell's multi-billion dollar effort to find oil in federal Arctic waters is a thing of the past. And yes, the Obama administration then took several steps to cut back on drilling in Arctic waters, actions the Trump administration is now working to undo. But it turns out there is movement to get oil out of federally owned parts of the Arctic Ocean. It's happening slowly and without a lot of fanfare.
Some maps here. That's where Liberty would be right here. And then I've got
Jim
some
Kendall
other ones here.
Is regional director for the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management in Alaska, one of the federal agencies that approves offshore drilling plans. He's showing me a map of the Beaufort Sea, where two companies are now leading efforts to produce oil from federal waters. First, Kendall is reviewing Hilcorp's Liberty project. The plan calls for producing oil from a man-made gravel island east of Prudhoe Bay as early as 2020. The other project, led by Italian company Eni, is at an earlier stage. Eni is working to get the final go-ahead to explore for oil west of Prudhoe this winter, using a gravel island in state waters. They aim to drill thousands of feet down, and then tens of thousands of feet horizontally to the north, to see if there's any oil there worth recovering. Both companies had their leases before the Obama administration limited Arctic development, so they've slipped past the influence of both Obama's and Trump's executive pens. Another reason these projects are happening below the national radar? Kendall says, in many ways, they don't compare to Shell's massive Arctic undertaking.
It's kind of apples and oranges.
Shell's exploration was far from shore and in waters well over 100 feet deep. Hilcorp and Eni's operations would be closer to land and pipelines and in waters not a lot deeper than an Olympic diving pool.
And maybe that's why it just hasn't caught a lot of attention. I mean, it's another gravel island. I mean, it's been done before. I mean, it's close to shore. It's not 70 miles offshore.
When Kendall says it's been done before, he's referring to a handful of existing man-made gravel islands in the Arctic Ocean companies are already drilling from. The key detail, though, is that these islands are in state waters. If it gets the final go-ahead, Hilcorp's Liberty Project would be the first project in Arctic federal waters to produce oil. It sounds like a big deal, and it is, but Hilcorp also wants to hit home the message that they're not doing something completely new. In Alaska, the company faces an extra level of public scrutiny after safety incidents like a gas leak from one of its fuel lines in Cook Inlet this spring. Mike Dunn, Hilcorp's project manager for Liberty, argues his project isn't especially risky.
From our perspective, I won't say it's simple, but it's been done often enough where we don't have to come up with some new technology. I mean, a lot of folks before us have figured this out.
Michael Levine with the Ocean Conservancy in Juneau acknowledges that compared to what Shell was trying to do, the risks for Hilcorp's and Eni's projects are better understood. But, Levine says, any drilling in Arctic waters is worth paying close attention to.
There are still massive industrial undertakings in a risky and remote place.
But do these projects mean there's still a promising future for oil drilling in Arctic waters? Oil industry supporters hope so. But beyond politics, Kendall says there are larger forces that have a big influence on that future. Oil prices and climate change.
If we have a longer drilling season, less ice, for some reason, oil prices go up again, then, of course, the market changes. And then industry, they have to decide what they would like to pursue.
Kendall says it's too early to say if the Eni and Hilcorp projects herald the triumphant return of big-time oil development in the Arctic Ocean. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
For the third year in a row, seabirds are washing up dead along the coastline in Alaska. Hundreds of birds have been discovered along a stretch of the Bering Sea from the Pribilof Islands and as far north as Deering. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more on what scientists think is causing the die-off.
Julia Parrish, an associate dean at the University of Washington, says seabirds work really hard, just trying to find dinner.
You're spending a heck of a lot of your day flying around looking for food.
And that means the birds have to consume enough fatty fish to sustain themselves. But Parrish says the thin bodies of the dead fulmars and shearwaters washing up on shore suggest the birds are struggling to find enough to eat. So far, about 800 have been discovered along the coast of the Bering Sea. Parrish says early lab results don't point to disease. It looks like the birds starved to death. In 2016, scientists documented the largest seabird die-off in the state, in the Gulf of Alaska.
And this is the next step in that progression.
Parrish says the mortality rate this year isn't as high. Still, scientists are concerned about the frequency of the die-offs. Before 2014, it wasn't uncommon to see seabird deaths every 3 or 4 years as the ocean ecology shifted.
And now we're seeing 1 to 2 a year. So that's a big difference. And it just points to a more rapid and persistent shifts in the system.
The Bering Sea has shown a trend of warming for about the past 50 years. According to the National Weather Service in Alaska, last year was the warmest year on record. And Parrish says that could be affecting the seabirds' regular feeding spots.
So if there's a shift in the system that takes away the prey that you're used to and replaces it with prey that you're not used to, you may literally be going to the wrong grocery store.
But Parrish says that doesn't mean the seabirds can't adapt if the warming trend continues. Humpback whales snack on commercial hatchery fish, which is an altered feeding behavior. And she says Alaska seabirds could eventually learn to visit new grocery stores, too.
So if the system changes majorly and everybody goes to the place they think the food is going to be and the food is not there, it's somewhere. So it's a bit of an arms race.
Whether the seabirds can keep up with their changing environment remains to be seen. Scientists are watching closely, as seabird deaths can signal the health of the entire ocean. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service say 64 walruses died on a northwest Alaska beach, and the animals may have been killed in stampedes. The agency told the Associated Press that the mostly young walruses were counted Monday near the village of Point Lay on the Chukchi Sea. The cause of the deaths hasn't been determined, but young walrus are vulnerable to being crushed if something startles a herd and sends animals rushing to the ocean. A polar bear, hunter, airplane, or boat can cause a stampede. Residents of Point Lay who hunt walrus for food expressed concern after seeing an airplane flying near the herd and possibly circling. Fish and Wildlife spokeswoman Andrea Madero says 30,000 to 40,000 walrus have been counted near Point Lay as they came ashore in late summer. Several national labs and universities will partner with the Alaska community of Cordova to field test new technologies on the city's electrical grid. The goal is to find innovations that could help the rest of the country avoid the kind of widespread power outages that have followed hurricanes Irma and Harvey. The U.S. Department of Energy has awarded more than $6 million for the project. Cordova Mayor Clay Copeland is also CEO of the city's electric cooperative. He says the grant is a win-win.
Cordova Electric's going to learn a lot about this technology, but the labs are going to learn a lot about actual microgrid environments and what does and doesn't. That's the way collaboration works.
Microgrids, or standalone electrical grids, are a necessity in much of rural Alaska, where there's no larger grid to connect to. But there's growing interest in the lower 48, especially after Hurricane Sandy and now Hurricane Irma left millions of people without power for days or weeks. Hospitals, military bases, and whole towns want to be able to disconnect from the larger grid and generate their own power in an emergency. Copeland says Alaska is a perfect laboratory, since communities have decades of experience running small grids.
It gives us an opportunity to share some of our capabilities, which is becoming in increasing demand from other countries. We're starting to recognize that Alaska has a lot of energy leadership on the electric energy side. It also gives us access to world-class technical resources.
Cordova will work with three national labs and several universities, along with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at UAF and the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Unalaska loses a cruise ship port call and a lot of tourist dollars.
We already have, you know, what we hope to make from them kind of built into our budget, and so it's just a loss.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters, and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Alaska's Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott has denied a proposed ballot initiative designed to offer greater protections for salmon habitat from mining or other development. The group Stand for Salmon proposed an initiative requiring water quality standards in Andromeda's fish streams and giving the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game greater authority to deny a development project if it would harm or alter salmon streams. Assistant Attorney General Elizabeth Bacalar recommended against certifying the initiative. In an opinion, she wrote the proposed bill would deprive the legislature of its exclusive discretion to allocate state assets among competing needs. Supporters of the measure were hoping to gather signatures and get the proposal on a statewide ballot. One of the initiative's sponsors, Mike Wood of the Susitna River Coalition and Sioux Salmon Company, was disappointed.
Since statehood, we had a very strong fish habitat permitting system. It's been whittled away from administration to administration over the years in favor of industry and development. And we're just trying to restore it back to where it was originally intended, to have some teeth and not to stop projects, but to be sure to give everybody on both sides assurance that if development happens, it will happen in a way that will not impact our fish resource.
Mallott's decision can still be appealed. Wood says the group may look to challenge the state's decision in court. The University of Alaska Fairbanks is building a heat and power plant to replace the old facility that went into service in 1964. The new $245 million power plant, scheduled to come online next year, will feature updated technology that will reduce most pollutants, but it will continue to emit greenhouse gases blamed for warming the planet. Many on campus say that conflicts with UAF's leadership in Arctic climate change research. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The work on UAF's 17-megawatt combined heat and power plant is about halfway done. And when the state-of-the-art facility goes online around December of next year, senior project manager Mike Ruckhouse says it'll be among the most environmentally friendly coal-fired power plants in the country.
From an environmental standpoint, this meets all of the current regulations and criteria.
That includes regulations related to the tiny particles called PM2.5 produced by combustion, which can foul Fairbanks' air during winter inversions.
So it's about as clean as you can get on PM2.5.
But the new plant will emit nearly 132,000 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent annually. That's 3% less than the old facility, but still roughly the amount of CO2 generated by 26,000 cars annually. Coal-fired power plants are the main source of atmospheric CO2, and even though it's a done deal and construction is well underway, UAF's new power plant still bothers some university researchers who study climate change and its impact on the Arctic.
From a scientific perspective, I understand the consequences of burning fossil fuels, and particularly for people that live in the Arctic and the subarctic.
Scott Rupp is a professor of forestry and deputy director of UAF's International Arctic Research Center. He says when university officials were debating a decade ago over what kind of power plant to build to replace the old one, he and others favored renewable energy options like hydro and solar.
It's disappointing, and my personal preference would be to have been able to continue to be a showcase of not only great science on climate change, but be able to put some of our innovation into how we power the Arctic university that we are.
Rupp and others acknowledge that locally mined coal from the Yosubeli operation in Healy was the only practical option for fueling the power plant.
We just still don't have natural gas in town, so obviously you can't rely on that, and you have to, at some point, have a plan and move forward on it.
University Regent John Davies says UAF's old power plant was well past its design life, and he says officials had to make a decision.
We had to replace the power plant because it was 50 years old and it was failing, and, you know, it could have been a major catastrophe if that plant had gone down in the middle of the winter.
Davies is a longtime advocate for clean air and energy efficiency, and he feels conflicted over the university's decision to build another coal-fired power plant.
You know, there certainly remains the irony that, you know, this is the only coal plant in the nation and that's being built, and we're also the leading group on understanding climate change and the need to reduce the emissions of fossil fuels to reduce greenhouse warming.
Davies says he hopes university officials will be able to choose natural gas or renewable energy when UAF replaces the new power plant a half century from now. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The Otna Native Corporation Board has rejected a proposed settlement with the state to allow continued public use of Cloutina Lake Road. The 25-mile road off the Richardson Highway near Copper Center crosses Otna land to the Cloutina River and Cloutina Lake. Otna declined an interview request, but a corporation press release says the proposal compromised Otna's private land use rights. State Department of Law spokeswoman Corey Mills says it would have maintained some public access.
It would be a 100-foot right-of-way, and people would be able to park on it, launch their boats from it where the river met the 100-foot right-of-way. But what the public would not be able to do was to camp or overnight park within the state right-of-way. Instead, Otna promised, if the settlement had gone forward, to provide camping areas for a fee.
Mills says the proposed settlement drew more than 400 public comments representing a range of views.
We had people who really were worried about the litter and other waste from people who use the area for camping and boating. And then we had the people who are avid users of the river who wanted to maintain it as open as possible.
Otna's rejection of the settlement sends the access issue back to court. Otna initially sued the state after a 2007 Department of Transportation maintenance project, it says, illegally widened the roadway and removed Otna Corporation signs and a fee station. Mills says the state considers the road an RS-2477 public right-of-way.
The state claims that this is one of those rights-of-way that, through historic use, became a public road. And so that's kind of what instigated this whole case back in 2008.
Mills says resolution of the case could set some precedent in regard to state claims on numerous other contested RS-2477 routes around Alaska. Attorneys for the state and Otna have to submit status briefs to the Superior Court by October 31st. A trial date has yet to be scheduled.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the family education loan so parents, spouse, or grandparents can help students with the cost of college or training programs in or outside of Alaska. Interest rates are lower than the Federal Plus, and no credit is required. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
The Kodiak Electric Association received a permit to start its Terror Lake Hydroelectric Project expansion, which would increase the lake's clean energy production. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
Part of the project includes construction through federal land, which requires a lengthy permitting process, with some steps KEA called duplicative. It had started on a legislative path to try to speed up that process, but KEA President and CEO Darren Scott says an agreement between the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service reached the same goal.
We actually, a while back, started the process with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and they worked together with FERC to kind of come together on some of the process as well, some of the permitting process, to kind of streamline the time on that. And with all that, we recently got our right-of-way permit with U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
According to legislative documents, FERC and the Fish and Wildlife Service entered into a memorandum of understanding for FERC to take the lead on that permitting process and avoid duplication. KEA plans to divert two streams in the Upper Hidden Basin into the reservoir through a 1.2-mile tunnel under Kodiak Island National Wildlife Refuge land. Scott says the expansion would help meet Kodiak's growing population and energy needs.
This gives Terror Lake about 25% more energy than it had before. So this should provide us several years for load growth as we see electrical loads growing in the town. And it's renewable. It keeps us in that renewable, near 100% renewable portfolio that we have, which has been incredibly successful for our town.
Scott says KEA will put the project out to bid in the fall and line up contracts in the winter. He says construction should start next summer, and they hope to complete the project in 2 years, but it could easily take three. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Nutrition-related health concerns plague the United States as a whole, and rural Alaska is no exception. But this fall, residents of a small Bristol Bay village are aiming to improve their health by eating only foods that are produced locally. KDLG's Avery Lill has more on Igiagig's Native Foods Challenge.
When Igiagig's high school literature class read In Defense of Food by Michael Pollan, they were hooked. In the book, Pollan details a 7-week project. A group of Aboriginal Australians who lived in the city and ate Western food moved to the outback and ate traditional food for 7 weeks. At the end of the period, all saw health improvements.
The kids in the class thought that'd be a great idea if we were to do this. So we pitched it to the community as a community idea, and the community members here were very excited about it.
That's Tate Gooden, Igiagig School's head teacher. For 6 weeks, starting September 17th, the adults and children in the village are challenging themselves to eat only traditional foods, foods they've grown locally, and oatmeal. For the past 8 months, the village has been putting away fish, berries, greens, and game.
It's gotten people a lot closer together and talking about food and subsistence. We have people putting up sourdough and different greens. We've got people boiling down caribou bones and making fat cake.
The project is a health experiment, so residents have already begun regular health screenings. Every month in 2017, they've taken their weight, blood pressure, blood sugar, and heart rate. They'll compare the results from before and after the challenge. The final component of the challenge is a trek to Big Mountain, about 20 miles away from Igiagig. For 4 days in the last week of September, the village will hike to the mountain, which is a traditional meeting place between Igiagig and the village of Kakanak. At Big Mountain, they'll have a native foods potluck. The challenge concludes October 28th. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
A 2,000-passenger cruise ship was supposed to dock in Unalaska today. Instead, it decided to go to Sitka. Although Unalaska is known as America's top fishing port, tourism, in particular the cruise ship industry, is a growing source of revenue, especially for small businesses and nonprofits. KUCB's Zoe Sobel looks into what caused the vessel to change ports.
Locals say they've been left scrambling, trying to figure out how to make up tens of thousands of dollars in lost revenue from the Celebrity Millennium's canceled visit. Virginia Hatfield is the executive director for the Museum of the Aleutians, which is one of the only places cruise ship passengers can learn about the culture and history of the region.
It's a big loss for that ship to not come here. It's about $20,000, maybe even $30,000 of lost revenue for us. And it's important. This is what we use to put up exhibits and to buy merchandise for the store and to pay salaries and health benefits for our staff.
The Museum of the Aleutians isn't the only organization that was counting on increased traffic from the cruise ship. Carlin Enlow, executive director of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, estimates that the Celebrity Millennium would have distributed at least $100,000 across museums, restaurants, and stores.
It's not going to happen, and it's a bummer. And so the biggest thing that I hope comes out of this is that people realize what these businesses and organizations do for these cruise ships and how we do come to rely on it.
Even though the fishing industry is the bread and butter of Unalaska, Enlow says trans-Pacific sailings are increasing. And with the Northwest Passage opening up to cruise ships, the city is likely to see even more boats in the future. So what caused the cancellation of the Celebrity Millennium's port call? A lack of available facilities.
We did have some options if they could delay for a couple hours, that they could come in at that point. I don't think that worked with what they were trying to accomplish, and ultimately they made a decision to change that protocol.
That's Ports Director Peggy McLaughlin. With the city dock under construction, cargo operations, and requirements from the vessel, there was only so much that she could do. And this incident raises a big question about Unalaska's future.
If the city believes that the cruise ship industry is something that we want to diversify toward, what is the infrastructure that the city is prepared to commit to that?
With more cruise ships expected next year, she thinks putting numbers to the revenue generated by the vessels and understanding the benefits the industry brings to local businesses and nonprofits is important. While Museum Director Virginia Hatfield understands why the ship canceled, she says cruise ship profits are vital to the museum and help fund services that grants won't cover.
The more we make from these cruise ships, the less we have to ask from the city, you know, to help us get by.
Three more cruise ships are scheduled to stop in Unalaska this fall. Enlow says she's heard rumors that two of them may be considering canceling their port calls too. If that happens, she estimates that could be another $100,000 loss for small businesses and nonprofits across the city. In Unalaska, I'm Zoe Sobel.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage, Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Avery Lill in Dillingham, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.